Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Just head to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders, past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
If the worst case scenario happened that I did die, are we already in an emotional position where we have our mindset that it was conscious, we know what we were doing? In fact, I even had a conversation with my wife prior to the shooting about, if I die, what are you going to tell my children about the person I am, that I knew I might be killed in this situation, but I still thought there was value in doing it? And this is about the person I am, the value to society, contribution to other people, all those sorts of things. I wanted to make sure that my wife would pass that message on to my children so that they knew what I was considering.
That's international speaker and coach Derek McManus, and this is Reframe of Mind.
The podcast that cuts through the platitudes and gets to the core of living authentically, challenging our assumptions and improving mental health with the guidance of good science, philosophy, and learning from other people's lived experiences.
We're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy Leroy.
We've all had a bad day at work or frozen ourselves into inaction because of the fear something bad might happen if we act on something.
But it wasn't until we spoke to Derek McManus that we truly got some perspective around the idea of the worst that could possibly happen.
Ooh, yeah. Derek McManus's background is an Australian police sniper, diver and counter-terrorist operative.
For those not familiar with Derek's story, buckle in. He's also widely known as the man who miraculously survived 14 bullet wounds that he sustained in less than 5 seconds.
Yeah, on this particular day at work, Derek had no alternative but to lie on the ground for 3 hours waiting to be rescued. And to this day, doctors don't know how he survived.
I mean, commercial radio was pretty tough for me. I don't recall almost bleeding out at work on any of my days that I was present, though.
No, and, you know, of course, not to underplay yours or anybody else's other experiences, though, it's all relative, and this is something that we'll also explore with Derek.
So Derek was a part of the STAR group, which, if you're from a state that's not South Australia, you might not know what that is. Andy, you're the resident South Australian. Would you like to explain the language to the rest of us?
Exactly. This is kind of like one of those things where South Australians call togs bathers, or they call Devon Fritz, that kind of stuff.
Don't get us started on the scallops. Debate. Potato scallops all the way.
I know. Yeah, I'm with you there, though, because I came from Sydney. Yeah. Anyway, the STAR group is the Special Tasks and Rescue Group. So every state will have their own tactical response group. These are the people that go in when there's, you know, quite an acute situation. You know, you might see them get called in if there's a siege or a particularly volatile kind of situation. So that's the level at which Derek was working at the time.
Mm-hmm. So in New South Wales, that would be like the equivalent of the State Protection Group, or what is it in Queensland? The CERT group.
Yeah, CERT.
CERT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
CERT.
CERT. I didn't know that.
Special Emergency Response Team.
Either way, it sounds like their job is really dangerous.
Yeah, I think that you could possibly say that you could go to work any day in that job and maybe think that you could be saying goodbye to people for the last time, not to be flippant about it, but it's that kind of level of danger.
So the day that Derek went to work that we're talking about, his team had been asked to arrest a high-risk offender. The offender started shooting. Derek was the target. 14 bullets ripped into Derek. Derek's body, shattering bones, severing arteries, and tearing through organs.
The first doctor that actually got to Derek on site commented how, you know, when he first saw him, he thought he was actually already dead.
In a lot of his public speaking, Derek often talks about the 14 bullets, the 3 hours on the ground, his years of rehabilitation that followed. We don't want to take that approach with him this time. We want to talk about something that isn't often talked about, which is what comes next.
Yeah, it's very easy to get stuck in those, you know, salacious details and the, you know, the big flashpoint stories. But the centerpiece of Derek's story is the stuff about his determination to survive, his ability to set goals in those moments, in those 3 hours while he was on the ground, building personal belief and overcoming challenges and the changes that come out of that.
People have told me I'm very, very lucky that it wasn't 13 times. I don't know how the 14th makes it lucky, but, you know, I get where they're coming from.
Is that because it was a superstition on the number 13, that would have somehow been worse?
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah. Yes. 13 would have been worse than 14. I don't know how that works.
One of the things that kind of really grabs me while I was, you know, listening to some of the interviews that you've done in the past is you're talking through and you have vivid memory of the experience itself and how your body was shutting down and the thoughts that were running through your mind at the time. And one of those thoughts was that you just needed something to live for.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, there are so many aspects to what I talk about from the experience and what I now have learnt. But one of them is that we do need something to fight for. Fighting for our own life is one thing, and it's very important to do that. But what I was fighting for was for my children. I'd had an experience, and this is something that many people wouldn't have heard. I had an experience 2 months prior to my shooting where another policeman was killed, and I won't go into those details, but another policeman was killed. I got to spend time with his two young boys who had now been left without a father. I was already a stepfather to two children. And then within our marriage, we had two biological children. And as I was spending time with his two young boys, I thought to myself, I'm a great stepfather, but it doesn't matter how good a stepfather is, it's never as good as your own father. And if I ever get into a situation where I need to fight, I am going to fight to be here for my children as long as I possibly can. And that was one of the things that ran through my mind. So I wasn't just fighting for me, I was fighting for something bigger than me. And when we can find that something bigger than ourselves to fight for, we actually find a lot more power, a lot more strength.
How much do you feel like fate might have actually played a part in how things transpired?
Fate?
Hmm.
I'm not a fatalist, not in any way, shape or form. I look at this and, you know, to be quite honest, I've got a very different perspective to what most people think. My perspective to this overall is I went to work, I got shot, I fell down, I got up, I got better, I went back to work. And that for me is as simple as it is. Now, I'm able to have that perspective because I took a very serious look at the choices that I was making in my life. I made a choice to become a policeman. That's a very dangerous job. I've been in several situations where people have pulled guns and pointed them in my direction and tried to shoot us. Fortunately, it hadn't happened prior to the day where I was shot. But I'd been in several situations. I knew that that job that I was choosing to do was dangerous. I then went into what we call Star Group, the Special Operations Section, Special Tasks and Rescue Star Group. I became a sniper. I became an underwater recovery diver, which is very dangerous in its own realm. I went away and trained with the SAS in counterterrorism. So I had to take a very close look at the choices that I was making and the possible consequences of them. Now, that wasn't fate. That was a choice I consciously made. I put myself in a situation where I may be shot and injured. I may be shot and killed. And so when it did happen, I'd already prepared myself physically, mentally, and emotionally. The emotionally is a very important one. But I prepared myself physically, mentally, and emotionally for the choices that I'd made and the possible consequences of those choices. There was nothing in fate about it at all. I retract that just slightly. The very fortunate maybe fate was on my side was that I was hit 14 times. I had a severed artery in my left forearm. And as you might be aware, if you sever an artery, you bleed profusely and die very quickly. That severed artery closed down on both ends of the artery and didn't bleed. Doctors don't know why it does this. It does it randomly in, you know, different people, but it did it for me. I had a severed artery in my right wrist, but the piece of shrapnel that severed that artery stayed in there and blocked it. I had two bullets into my stomach. I lost 15 centimetres of large intestine, 30 centimetres of small intestine, but didn't hit a kidney, didn't hit a spleen, didn't hit the heart, didn't hit the lungs. So I was very fortunate. Now, people may call that fate that I was fortunate, but, you know, there was that little bit of what I call luck. That part of it was just pure luck. I had no control over where those bullets hit.
So Derek's story isn't simply a story of someone being shot and recovering. It's a story of someone who had already considered and prepared for their worst case scenario as they entered a profession where death was a real possibility.
When the shooting happened, he discovered it wasn't as bad as most of us fear when imagining the worst. And something that could potentially have been the worst day of someone's life was just another day at the office for Derek.
I am the maker of my own destiny, if you want to look at it that way. And I still believe that applies to me even now. In my own business of speaking, my raising my children, my driving my car, we all make choices and we need to take responsibility for those choices. Sure, there's a little bit of luck that plays in lots of different things, but the majority of our life is as a result of choices we consciously make or try to not make. Because sometimes we just try to avoid it or live in denial. But I am very aware that it's, you know, my choices have put me in circumstances where things can happen, good and bad. And that's an important one to remember too. Mm. We make choices that have great results, but sometimes people focus only on the negative ones.
That philosophy of now that we make our own, we make our own destiny, we're the masters of our own choices. Was that because of the incident or was that something that you already had as a life belief before that?
Definitely a life belief before that. So when I talk about taking responsibility for choices, I went one step further again than what most people do. Being a policeman, everybody knows that we are in situations where we may be shot and injured, we may be shot and killed. Everybody knows that. In Australia, we wear guns on our hips. In America, you know, policemen are shot and on a way too regular basis. But everybody's aware. But very few coppers actually talk about, I may be shot and injured, I may be shot and killed, with their partners and say, if these things happen, what's our life going to look like? So prior to the shooting, I actually sat down with my wife and I said, hey, listen, reality is going into Star Group, high risk arrest, hostage siege, counter-terrorism. Chances are I may be shot and injured, and if I get injured, I may spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. Now, if that happens, are you still willing to support me for the rest of our lives together? And, you know, I was therefore ensuring that I had her support, and it was a conscious support of she knew what the risks are. I also had to have the conversation, I may be shot and injured, but I may be shot and killed, and if I die, what's your life going to look like? And we discussed all the possibilities of she may go on and get married again and have more children and, you know, a stepfather to look after the children. Obviously, that was comfortable with me. She may stay single and just look after our children and dedicate herself to our children. That was comfortable for me. It was basically whatever she wanted. I also did give her the option of building a little shrine in the corner of the lounge room and worshipping every day. Apparently that one wasn't all that popular, but, you know, I threw it in there.
I'm just curious, Derek, this chain of logic that you obviously are very good at doing in these critical situations particularly, is this something that you've always carried or something that came through your training when you were training through the police force?
Certainly training in the police force has helped me to hone it. Training in Star Group makes maybe hone it even more. Star Group are very, very serious about contingency planning. Going into training and looking at every possible scenario. What's the worst case scenario and how can you make the best of it? How can we overcome that? The US Navy improvise, adapt and overcome type attitude. But I think it's something that I've had inherently. I didn't know I had it. But having those conversations with my wife prior to going into the shooting and lots of other things as well. Even before I joined Star Group, when I was working on general patrols, my patrol teams would come into the office and we'd be sitting around having coffee and we would play what-if scenarios, hypotheticals, and say, if you get into this scenario, what might you do in that situation? What might you do in this situation? And we had, you know, the ridiculous answers. It wasn't just all serious. It was just playing with the possibilities. But out of that playing came some very serious stuff that not only helped me, but helped other people as well. So it's just an approach that I seem to have always had in my life.
So through his tactical training, Derek had got used to using calculated risk in his life, which is very different to the typical picture of a risk taker.
So how could we compare this to someone like, I guess, I don't know, one of the Red Bull daredevils that we see who are jumping out of planes and jumping off cliffs, that sort of thing? Because you describe yourself not as a risk taker, but as a risk manager.
Yeah, the Red Bull guys, they're pussies. They're pussies. No, every admiration for those guys. They do some amazing stuff. My job was very similar to that. Our fitness level was the same as it was compared to AFL footballers type level of fitness. The jobs that we were going into were certainly full of risk, and we do a lot more riskier stuff than anybody else could possibly imagine. People shudder when I tell them some of the things that I've done, and I enjoyed doing it at the time. But as you say, I see myself not as a risk taker, as much as I do lots of risky stuff. And I, even since the shooting, I've jumped out of airplanes with parachutes and all that sort of stuff. So I'm still doing risky stuff, but I see myself as a risk manager, not a risk taker, because I take a look at my training, my experience, my fitness, my support around me, the infrastructures, all those sorts of things that give me good reason to believe that I've got a better than average chance of outcome of success. And I've got lots of friends who look at high adrenaline stuff and high risk stuff, and they go, "Oh, Derek, that's right up your alley. You would do that." And there are times where I look at it and I go, "Do you know something? No, I wouldn't. I can see the risk, I can see the management, but I don't think I'd get enough excitement or pleasure for myself out of doing it that's worth that risk." And so I will back away from things that people go, "Derek, that's right up your alley." Because there's got to be a reward for it, for me, for doing that. It's got to be something I enjoy doing. I don't take risks just purely for adrenaline. It's got to be something that I enjoy. And then I start managing it. What is my training? What is my experience? Who are the people around me that support me? So it's a very managed type situation the majority of the time. Now, having said that, I have a philosophy that the greater the risk, the greater the planning. There are still lots of times in my life where I go, I don't know about this one, but let's have a crack. Let's see how it goes. And there's very little risk management that goes into it. But the risk overall is very small. It might be that I will twist an ankle, or I might lose $20 in a gambling or a betting situation. It's not going to destroy my life. And it's like, even if the worst case scenario goes, it's only going to be a hiccup. The more dangerous the situation is, the more planning, the more consideration we've got to give to it. And that's when risk management really comes to the fore. Most of the stuff that we manage on a day-to-day basis, we've done it so often, we actually go through the risk management in our mind without even thinking about it. It runs through the scenario of, I've done this before, last time I did it, it turned out well, or last time I did it, it turned out badly, but I know why it turned out badly, so I'm going to do it differently this time. Let's go. Now, when you go into a larger risk, you've got to start taking a larger look at how you manage that, and possibility of being shot and injured, possibility of being shot and killed. That's when I sat down and had that discussion with my wife. This is a very serious risk. The impact could be catastrophic on my life and your life. Are we both prepared to take that risk? Do we have the resources to be able to manage it? And if the worst case scenario happened that I did die, are we already in an emotional position where we have our mindset that it was conscious, we know what we were doing? In fact, I even had a conversation with my wife prior to the shooting about, if I die, what are you going to tell my children about the person I am that I knew I might be killed in this situation, but I still thought there was value in doing it? And this is about the person I am, the value to society, contribution to other people, all those sorts of things. I wanted to make sure that my wife would pass that message on to my children so that they knew what I was considering. So it's a very conscious thing that I was going through, and I don't know where I got it from. I put it down to my parents, brought me up that way. My brother's very similar. My sister has lots of those skills as well. And we all do very different jobs. My brother is a entrepreneurial type person. He's run his own business. He's now general manager of an air conditioning company. And I laugh wryly because he says, "Derek, I don't care how many risks you take and how much pain you went through when you got shot. If I get a paper cut in the office, I'm still going to whinge about it because it damn well hurts." So it kind of puts it in perspective. And I completely respect that. And that puts in perspective for everybody else as well. People go, "Oh my gosh, after hearing what you've been through, what I'm going through is nothing." No, what you are going through is still significant for your life. And I've been shot many times and got through that pain, but if I twist my ankle or hurt my thumb, I still feel the pain and it still troubles me, you know, 24/7 until that pain is gone. So everything has to be put in perspective of how it's affecting your life at the moment. I mean, we can all look at life and go, in Ethiopia, they are suffering, so we should never, ever complain in our lives. No, let's put it in perspective. It's still difficult for you at that time. But there's things that we can learn from other people that have been through these experiences and how to manage them better and put it into perspective.
I think you almost answered my entire question just then. But the next one that I was going to ask you, because if you are a risk manager, not a risk taker, but you chose to go into a high risk profession, several high risk professions, what was the drive that made you make that? Was that wanting to feel like you contribute to society?
That was the bottom line for me. It seems to be a theme throughout my life that I want to contribute and help other people achieve what they want to achieve. And I have certain skill set that allows me to do that in many different arenas. Going into the police department was certainly one of those drives for me. I remember saying, I just want to be able to get in there. It's an opportunity to help people. And this is as a 16, 17 year old. Once I got into the police department, I found that, you know something? As much as we help people, it's only a touch point. We get in there and we diffuse a crisis, but we don't spend long term with these people. And so there was a reality check for me there. And at one point I started saying, I'm not getting as much out of the police department as what I would like to. And I was looking for other jobs. And when I came across Star Group, and I've gone, do you know something? I was looking outside the police department. I was looking at all sorts of different managerial type jobs. Somebody said to me, why don't you join Star Group? I took a look at Star Group, and Star Group was about me enjoying myself as well as contributing. Because Star Group, you know, we have planes, we have boats, we have helicopters, we have weapons, we have camping, we have abseiling, we go search and rescue underwater, search and rescue throughout the bush, all those sorts of things that I love. We've got every boy's toy you could possibly imagine. It was absolutely sensational. So part of it was about me enjoying myself while still being able to contribute. And that was certainly very important for me. And I actually have forgotten the drive of your question. Is it because I wanted to...
Yeah, what drove you to take the risks if you are, you know, so conscious of the risks?
We all have a certain skill set. And one of my skill sets is to be able to manage risks, both physically as well as emotionally. And that's a very clear distinction I make, because when our emotion takes over, all our training, all our experience, all our knowledge goes out the window because our emotion's driving it. And when our emotions go high, our rational thinking goes low. And that's when we go into fight and flight. That's when we go into panic mode. And if we're able to manage our emotions, and now this is not eliminate emotions, if we're able to manage our emotions, bring our emotion back down, our rational thinking will naturally come back up. And I seem to have a natural flair for being able to do that. So going into something like Star Group, I was comfortable. Somebody needs to step up and do that job. Somebody also needs to step up and do accounting, because I do not like accounting. So I'm looking for a good accountant all the time. Everybody has their own skill set, and we need to follow that path, so long as there's value in it for you. And it's a contribution to society as well. And this was the path that I took because I felt I had a skill set for it.
It's really interesting though, like, because people don't go through those kind of, like, they don't do that kind of planning for worst case scenario. I saw in one of the, I think it was a talk you were doing, a corporate talk that I saw on YouTube this morning, one of the ones that you said is, it's okay if I end up in a wheelchair because then I'm going to win a Paralympian gold.
And that
is a brilliant reframe. Like, was that in this planning stage before you've entered into, you know, high risk career, or was that something after when you weren't sure if maybe you would recover functionality?
Again, I'm going to tell you that I'm a little bit different to most people, because I'd certainly spoken to my wife about the possibility I may spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. And if that happened, then I'm comfortable with that because I'm making that conscious choice, blah, blah, blah. But the bit about the wheelchair actually came to me when I was lying on the ground with bullets in my stomach and bullets in my body. And I was lying on the ground for 3 hours trying to get my head around and control my mind and my body. And I was feeling my body closing down. I could feel the blood draining from my body. And there's lots of build up to this story of how I've managed to get myself into a relaxed state of mind because of things the shooter was doing. I knew where he was at certain times. And when I knew where he was and he wasn't a threat to me, I was able to have thoughts just that little bit outside the square. And as I was lying on the ground, I knew where he was. He was in the roof of the house. He wasn't a threat to me. I had everything sort of calmed down and I started to look at what the future might look for me. And again, I thought I may spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. And I thought to myself, well, if I spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair, it's not going to be the exciting life that I have at the moment. Jumping in and out of helicopters, flying here and there, climbing cliffs, meeting people, all this sort of stuff. And I thought, how can I make my life interesting? And I thought, well, I already play basketball. So if I've already played basketball and I put that together with wheelchair, I may be able to play wheelchair basketball. And that wasn't too bad. I thought that's something that'll be of interest. Now, this is while I'm on the ground. Now, remember, I was lying there for 3 hours. The shooter was shooting almost continuously while I'm lying on the ground for 3 hours. And these are the thoughts that are running through my head because I had everything in control. Everything that I could possibly do for my body, I had it all in control. So I started looking at that future and I thought, wheelchair basketball, this is not going to be a bad option. And then I started thinking, I may be able to make the Paralympic team. And then I started thinking, if I make the Paralympic team, I can add a little bit to what those guys already are brilliant at. We may be able to make the Paralympic finals. I may be able to get a gold medal as a result of getting shot. Now, as you say, that's a kind of reframe because I wasn't just looking at the worst case scenario. I was going, what other options are available to me? I made the choice to put myself in this situation. The consequences I thought might happen have happened. It's now up to me to make my future as good as it possibly could be. And I was already doing that while I was on the ground. The blood was draining from my body. And the blood supply in my body got so low that even my vision closed down because there wasn't enough blood going to my brain to keep my vision going. And I saw this absolute pristine white. It was absolute pristine white that many people have spoken about, you know, being that end of life. And even at that point, I thought to myself, if I get out of this alive, and it wasn't if, it wasn't I'm definitely going to fight and I'm definitely going to make it. It was if I do. I may end up with brain damage. I may end up with some sort of damage to the body because of lack of oxygen. But it was always looking at what will it be like in the future. I knew the possibility that it may end, but I always had that look at the future as well. And that's what I was fighting for. And it was my kids that gave me the focus and determination to keep fighting as much as I possibly could.
Something that I'm really interested in, based on what you said, is when you were in those 3 hours and then you saw that white light, what else happened? Is there more to that?
Well, there's a great lot of depth to everything that was happening on the ground. Tell lots of stories about what I thought, what I was going through. But at the time that my vision closed down and I saw the white light, it did run through my mind, is this what people talk about? Is this the white light of God? And I'm not a religious person, but it ran through my mind, is this what they're talking about? Is this the white light of God? But the dominant thought for me was about my children. Yeah. And when I saw that white light, I started fighting even harder than I had before. It wasn't just lying on my back, trying to control my mind and body. I started moving my body just to give myself confidence I had something left. And I wasn't moving a lot, but it was enough to go, yes, I've still got something. I started speaking out loud to myself and consciously out loud saying, Derek, don't give up. Derek, keep on fighting. Now, I talk about looking for best case scenarios and worst case scenarios. As my vision was closing down, within about 15 seconds to 2 minutes, because time frame isn't real good in that period. As my vision was closing down, there were two rifle shots from outside the house. I could still hear the shooter inside the house. And when I heard those two rifle shots, it was absolute confirmation for me that my mates from Star Group were on their way to get me and things were going to be all right. I believe there was a dump of adrenaline into my body, endorphins and whatever else from the brain because of that belief that there was something optimistic that was going to happen. I had that sense of optimism, something was going to happen. And my vision snapped back up to absolutely perfect. And I was passing in and out of consciousness for the next 15 minutes before they got to me. But it's that sense of optimism, that dump of adrenaline. There is still something possible that's going to come out of this, you know, something good that's going to possibly come out of this that went through my mind at that time. But as much as I knew that this was the end of life vision that I was having, that white light, I still was never going to give into it.
Mm.
I kept on fighting. And if I had died, I would have been quite comfortable that, you know, I'd made that choice and it's something that's happened. I wasn't scared of death per se. I was very comfortable that I might die, but I wasn't going to give into it. And I just kept on fighting with every little bit that I had. And fortunately, it did turn out well.
It'd be fair to expect Derek to be grappling with PTSD after his near-death experience, but in the end, it was something quite different that impacted him that he hadn't even figured into his planning. I was interested to read along the way that your response to the concept of PTSD, that you've said that you didn't actually have any PTSD related directly to the experience of being shot and almost dying, but it was more around other people's responses to that. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so at the time of being shot, I was already having light-hearted conversations and jokes with myself about, you know, the shooting itself and about what might happen afterwards, and very happy to elaborate on what those, you know, light-hearted conversations were. And that was as the bullets were hitting me, right? I was already able to have those conversations. I think that's because I was well prepared beforehand, physically, mentally, and emotionally, so that when I got into the situation, I knew exactly what to do, and I already had an anticipation of what it might be like afterwards. And when I was in hospital going through my recovery, about 5 days after the shooting, I threw my hand in the air and said, "Get me a psych. I want to talk to a psych." Now, you've got to remember, this is 27 years ago, and males and psychologists, therapists, it wasn't a natural fit for most people, but I was very comfortable with it. And when I threw my hand in the air 27 years ago in this testosterone embedded environment where people are so tough they would never talk to it, and I've gone, "Excuse me, guys, I'd like to talk to someone and get some therapy," you can imagine what the response was like. But it was one of the most powerful things I could do. I went to one of the best trauma psychs in Australia, Dr. Sandy McFarlane, and we had about a 3-hour meeting, and he picked my brain about how I'd prepared, what it felt like when I was in the shooting, what I'm anticipating going through now. I picked his brain about how do people deal with these things and manage them well? How do they manage them badly? What's the difference? At the end of that meeting, he said, "Derek, you can psychologically go back to work tomorrow." Cleared, go back to work tomorrow. Physically, I couldn't do it for 2.5 years, but this was 3 months after the shooting. Psychologically, he cleared me to go back to work the next day and never needed to come back and see him again. And this is a lot of where I talk about human durability rather than resilience. I talk about durability. This is where a lot of that comes from, because I had prepared myself prior to it so that when I experienced it, I already had an anticipation of what I was going to go through, had an anticipation of what it would be like afterwards. And because I had prepared myself so well, I believe, I didn't experience the post-traumatic stress afterwards. I'd already dealt with it beforehand. If this happens, I know what I'm going to manage. I know what I need to manage. This is what I'm going to experience. I've got the skills to be able to manage that. Bang, let's go and take the risks and manage the risks. I've never actually experienced PTSD in relation to the shooting. My management, and I'm trying to be very politically careful here in how I phrase this, some of the managers at work didn't manage me returning to work as well as what I would have liked. They were putting up roadblocks. Like, I've been cleared by the psychiatrist a couple of times because I did go back for review and just check in to make sure everything was okay, and he again cleared me. I'd also been cleared by occupational therapists, nurses, and doctors, and all sorts of people physically to go back to work. And despite all that, there were still people who couldn't understand. Somebody's been shot 14 times. They've been through all that trauma. They can't come back into Star Group and be in Star Group again. It didn't make sense to them. So they were putting up roadblocks. But I didn't see that they were putting up roadblocks. I just couldn't understand why they wouldn't let me pass the tests. They gave me tests. They said, "Derek, we want you to pass this test. If you can do this physically, you can come back in." And when I did that and jumped through the hoops and got over the hurdles, they said, "Oh, right, well, that was just a trial. The real test is this one." And then when I passed that, "Oh, well, actually, what we really need you to do," and it just got harder and harder. Now, around the same time, I'd also separated from my wife. We were going through divorce. I didn't have 24/7 access to the children that kept me alive during that shooting. My social circles were, you know, dismantled because, you know, when you're going through divorce, all those things sort of get a disconnect before you get settled again. I wasn't sleeping well. I wasn't eating well. And then the crux of it was that my dog died. And that broke me down in tears. That just destroyed me. And I started realizing that my life wasn't as solid as what I would have liked. And I didn't realise I was going through a depression. All I knew was I didn't have the energy, I didn't have the enthusiasm. And I did the analysis for myself and I've gone, but I'm not eating well, so I must be missing some vitamins. So I'm just going to go along to the doctor and find out what pill I need to take to boost up my vitamins. And he gave me a questionnaire for anxiety, depression and PTSD. And I remember thinking in my mind, mate, I've been through the shooting, gosh. And if I get through the shooting without any stress, nothing's going to stress me. And he gave me the test. I filled it in, you know, completely transparently, obviously. And he said, Derek, you've got mild depression and you've got mild PTSD. I remember sitting there and going, damn, geez. And then instantly said, okay, how do we manage this? And it was that acceptance, I think, that was one of the critical turning points for me, because I'd had the discussion with the psychiatrist before. I may get depression, I may get flashbacks, I may get nightmares, I may have traumas when I hear sounds, watch movies. This is all a reality that could happen. And if it does, these are the things I'll do to manage it. The doctor saying that you've got depression and PTSD, that was a reality check for me. Yes, I now recognize it. One of the things that happens is when we get into that depression, PTSD, we are so overwhelmed, our emotions are high, but in a low way. Our emotions aren't working properly. We are being sucked down into this vortex where we are overwhelmed by the slightest little thing. Our rational thinking is not working well. We're not able to logically process information. And so we just get overwhelmed and kind of give up. And that's where I was. I was just giving up. But when I got to the doctor and he said, Derek, this is the reason you don't have energy, it was like, bang, I know what to do now. Took every bit of advice the doctor told me. Now, I've got to stress, it was mild depression, mild PTSD. Did everything the doctor told me to do. Came back a month later for a checkup. And he said, Derek, it has moved on. It's passed. You've recovered. You can go back to work and do everything again normally. And I've never looked back. I noticed the highs in my life, but I also noticed the lows. And the lows are when I'm heading towards being depressed or just sad. And I call them depressive moments. And we all have them. Everybody has depressive moments where we're sad, we're upset, we're mad about something. If we manage it well, we can get back on track, and that's what I do now. I take particular notice of when my mood is affecting my behaviours and my enjoyment of life, and I say to myself, right, what do I need to do to get back on track? And I don't castigate myself for it. I don't get upset with the fact that I've got into a low mood, because that's natural. We all do. But it's about having a conscious system for getting back on track.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
It's interesting when you said that, you know, the death of your dog is the thing that pushed you over the edge on that, because it's very personal to me, because that's exactly the same thing that I've experienced with things. You know, you can have a pile-on of shit after shit after shit, and it's okay. But then, particularly when it comes to, I think, you know, when an animal passes away, that's the thing that it's the thing I can't deal with on top of all the other things. Which, what I'm getting at is, you know, pain is pain, grief is grief, regardless
Absolutely.
Of what it's about.
Absolutely.
So this kind of, with your, was it your brother and the paper cut?
Yes, yes.
So is that your experience, that it's so hard when everyone should think it's the other thing, but grief
yes.
and pain, they're all the same regardless of whatever it is that you're talking about?
I think, you know, the death of a pet, a loved pet, is very similar to the death of a child. It's someone you love. A death of a child, death of a parent, death of a, you know, partner. It's someone you love. We should be well prepared for it, that we know that, you know, a dog's life is only 13, 15, 18 years at the most. So we know we're going to have a couple of pets in our lives. But when they pass, it's still sore, it's still raw. I think the reason that the death of the dog tipped me over the edge at that time, because, you know, we've had other pets in my life and they have passed as well. It didn't tip me over the edge into depression. But I'm sure you've heard the analogy of our ability to manage stress is like having a bucket. I look at the bucket in a slightly different way. If your bucket only has a little bit in the bottom, the rest of that bucket the 9/10 of the rest of that bucket is our processing space to be able to manage emotions, thoughts, feelings, challenges. But if we start throwing more and more in the bucket, so I had my bosses at work giving me a hard time and making it hard for me. I then started to withdraw from work and not interacting with the other guys. My social circles had been decimated. I'd separated from my wife. I didn't have access to my children. All these things are starting to fill that bucket up. And the amount of processing space at the top is getting less and less and less. And that's when people talk about the straw that broke the camel's back was something so small. You know, when people are joking at work and then they'll make a joke and someone will just snap and they go, oh my gosh, what happened? You know, normally it takes that well. Unfortunately, the bucket for that person has got so full that that one little joke that they normally take so well has just been the straw that breaks their back, and they snap and they bite and they get upset with you and they'll come back afterwards and apologize. But it's they don't have the processing space because of lots of other maybe little things that are happening in their life that nobody else is aware of. Part of it is just accepting I've got lots of things on my plate. I know my processing space is very, very small. When it gets to this point, what do I do? How do I manage myself? And this is when I talk about high-performance people and high-performance mental health. And one of the most important things about being high-performance is to know that when your bucket is getting full, you have strategies, tools, or things that you can do that de-stress you. Now, lots of people in business will go, you know, I've got to the level of being a high performer. I've got to stay there. I can't take time off. If I take a holiday, I'm still going to be working during my holiday. But we need to be able to get away from work. We need to be able to spend time with our family, spend time with our children, going and getting a massage and doing the hobbies that we love doing. We've got to continue those things because they take you completely outside of the thoughts of work and stress and all the rest of it. Doesn't mean that they're not still there, but it just means that your mind is not focused on them and you're actually focusing in an area where you enjoy and you get all those endorphins and all those good chemicals that feed the brain and replenish the brain so that when you come back to deal with that stress again, you've actually got more energy, you're more relaxed, your mind is more open, you've got more space at the top of the bucket now for processing. But we've got to have a conscious way of going about that. We do it naturally when we're younger and when there's not so much on our plate, but as we get older, we seem to be more focused on making sure that we're doing our job well rather than managing our overall life and enjoying all of it. And that's a very broad brush statement. Not everybody does that. There are many people who do it very, very well, but sometimes those people who do go down with anxiety, stress, depression, burnout, and sometimes worse than that, obviously, that seems to be one of the common factors for me.
So it's interesting, Andy, isn't it? The parallel that I think we're starting to see here between Derek's recovery experience and that of Dr. Dinesh Palapana, who we spoke to in episode 2.
Yeah, Dinesh spoke quite candidly about how when he was recovering after his accident, from which he became a quadriplegic, that it was other people's opinions that were a major obstacle in his recovery process.
Yeah, not his own. Proving again that we are our own best authority on how far we can push ourselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of buzz now around the concept of resilience, but Derek makes an important distinction, I think, and he opts for a different model. We hear a lot these days about the term resilience, particularly after what we've all been through worldwide with the pandemic, but you made a distinction earlier about between resilience and durability. Would you mind just letting us
elaborating on that? Yeah,
just elaborate on what you see as the difference.
So, as I said, I talk about human durability, and human durability is the ability to go beyond resilience to sustaining optimal performance. A baseline model for this is I have a continuum that starts with fragility, has resilience in the middle, and durability on the other end. Fragility I describe as when we are brand new at doing something, we do it for the first time, we're very young at it, we're fragile because we're new, we're inexperienced, we make mistakes, sometimes we break things. And if you ever have somebody starting new with you or you have a child working with you, we kind of understand it's okay for them to make a mistake, but we're not as generous to ourselves about the mistakes we make. But these people are fragile. Now, with good coaching, mentoring, guidance, which we all need, we are able to take people and we're able to develop ourselves from being fragile new beginners to resilient performers. Now, when we move from fragile to resilience, this is where we go through the stages of learning how to solve problems. okay, I'm new at this. Boss, how do I fix this problem? Boss, what do I do with this? Partner, what do I do with this? You know, whoever it might be, we're getting that guidance. And we learn how to solve problems. And that's what resilience is. Resilience is the ability to bounce back. If something happens, I know how to fix it. I know how to bounce back. And we get really comfortable with ourselves where we go, doesn't matter what's going on. If anything goes wrong, come and talk to me. I know how to fix things. I'm resilient. And it's a very powerful place to be. And it's important to have resilience in our personal stores. But resilient isn't where we really want to be, because resilient is always bouncing back, always having to fix problems. It's waiting for things to happen so that you can bounce back. Now, if you remember, there was an explosion in the port of Lebanon. 3,000 kilograms of chemicals exploded and destroyed many of the houses and killed many people. The Lebanese government and the media were saying, the Lebanese people, they are resilient. They'll be able to bounce back. They'll get over this. We'll be able to rebuild. We will be fine. There was one lady that was interviewed, and she said, I'm tired of being resilient. I've been resilient all my life. I've been through the wars. I've been through, and now I'm going to have to be resilient. I don't want to be resilient anymore. I just want to be able to enjoy my life. And that, I think, is where we want to be. And that's what I describe as durability. Durability is where we know that our performance is 100% reliable. Everything we do, we know is going to go well. Everything that happens, it's predictable. We know exactly if this happens, I'll be able to see the signs. I'll be able to fix it before it goes wrong. It's where we're really comfortable. And if I make this analogy about these podcasts, when you first started running podcasts, your minds would have been going 1,000 miles an hour, going, oh my gosh, this is our first one. I hope it all goes right. Now that you're into it, I mean, talking to you guys this morning, it sounds as if you don't even bother talking about the setup. Oh, have we done this? Oh, of course I've done this. You've got it all. You're in a place now where you come and do these podcasts and you just go, excellent. I know this is going to be fine. We've done this so often. We know exactly what's going to happen. We know how to manage it. Everything goes really well. And I call that our comfort zone, our durability. We're 100% reliable. This is our comfort zone. And it's important to know where your comfort zone is and get into your comfort zone and enjoy your comfort zone. Because once we start enjoying our comfort zone, then we'll start looking around and going, I'm really comfortable. I'm not challenged. I want a new challenge. And that's when we'll take a leap from there and we will take on a new challenge. One of the important things about knowing where your comfort zone is that if you take a leap of faith and you take on a challenge and you crash and burn, many people burn back down to their basics. And we all know the term, you know, if things start going wrong, let's go back to basics. Well, basics is the day that you were fragile, the day you started in this. Your place, your comfort zone, you're 100% reliable. If you crash and burn and you come back to your comfort zone, that's when you start getting your confidence back. But not enough people are comfortable with their comfort zone. That's a very bad terminology. They're not aware enough of coming back to their comfort zone is where they get their power from. Because when you're back in that comfort zone, everything's going right. You're starting to get your confidence back again. Oh, yes, I know I can do this. This is what I've got. And so when we start out something brand new as fragile, we then move to resilience. We actually want to move to that 100% reliable. When we take that leap and we take on a new challenge, we've also got to understand that we will slide back along that continuum, because when we take a new leap, there's new learnings, there's new things to problem solve. So we will slide back from being 100% reliable back to, oh my gosh, I'm just resilient now. And if it's a really big challenge, you crash and burn, you may go back to fragile. But it's only in that one area of your life. The rest of your life is still good. Lots of people go, oh my gosh, I've embarrassed myself. I'm an idiot. My life is destroyed. People will think I'm useless. No, it's one area that you've made a mistake in. You are still a good husband or wife. You are still a good parent. You're still a good brother, sister. You're operating. You're able to manage that business well. It may be your finances you stuffed up in. It's not a reflection on your whole life. And again, that's a nuance that a lot of people go, oh, that makes sense. The other thing that when I talk about you slide back along the continuum from being 100% reliable to now being resilient and having to learn some new things. I was doing some work with some RAAF pilots, and one of the pilots said to me, really? Does that happen to everybody? And I've gone, yes, that's a very natural process. Everybody goes through it. He said, Oh, thank goodness for that. I thought it was just me. And that is a problem we've got. We get to that 100% reliable and we think everybody sees me as this, I can't change. I can't be vulnerable. I can't see that I'm, I can't let people see that I make a mistake. Otherwise, my reputation is going to be destroyed. But I believe it's the stronger person that's able to go, I'm learning something new here. Talk me through this. Give me your experience. Give me your training, your guidance, your support, your mentoring. And then you will get back to being that 100% reliable and into your comfort zone a lot faster than just trying to fight it on your own. But it is that everybody goes through it. And as I say, I work with the RAAF pilots, but I also work with kids in schools. Because as I say, challenges are challenges. You know, when they come, children sometimes come home to their parents and say, oh, so-and-so stole my book and it destroyed me. And we sort of laughed at ourselves. Oh my gosh, that's so cute. It's so small. It'll be nothing in your life. Unfortunately, that is their whole life at this stage. And that is as important to them as somebody else losing their business. And we've got to deal with that at their stage of reality and give it credence and deal with it just the same as my brother deals with his paper cuts. He would probably hate me if he ever hears me talking about his paper cuts like this. but he very consciously said it, and he said it in front of lots of other people because he likes to make fun of me as well. But the reality is that stolen book for that child is their reality. And the same process has worked for that child, has worked for the fighter pilots, has worked for you and your podcasts, has worked for me and my business now. It is a universal thing.
So how does your story after being shot 14 times fit onto that continuum? Because when you were assessing risk and reward, I'm sure you didn't have becoming a public speaker and telling these stories and doing all this on the list of things that might be a possible outcome? Or was it? Was this one of the possible outcomes you planned for?
I describe my journey into the speaking world as I was dragged in kicking and screaming. I did not want to come here in any way, shape or form. I was approached by corporates. I talk quite comfortably about it, obviously, and I've been doing it ever since the shooting. You know, I was cracking jokes with myself at the time the bullets were hitting me, and I've always been that way. It's not dismissive of seriousness, it's just being able to manage it well and manage the emotions. So when I got into an environment where I was talking to some corporates, they're going, you've got to come and tell my company about this. And I've gone, no way. Not because I was scared of the public speaking per se, but I thought they wanted a hero story. And as much as I like telling stories, I wasn't the hero on the day. The hero on the day were the guys that risked their lives to come in and get me out. The hero on the day was the doctor and the ambulance officers who stood in direct line of fire for 10 minutes, risking their lives to save mine. They were the heroes. If you want a hero story, go and talk to them. So I tried to get away from it. But I used a stack of blood. The body holds 10 units of blood. I used 24 units of blood in 7 hours. Mm-hmm. And the blood service came to me and said, Derek, you used a stack of blood. And they said, how would you like to tell your story? And just say thank you to blood donors for the difference that they've made in your life. And that was very comfortable for me because I wasn't telling a hero story for my sake. I was telling a hero story to say thank you. So it was all about them. And this again goes back to what it is that drives us. I was doing this for someone else. But once I started speaking to the blood donors, I found out that there were more messages in what I was saying than what I realized, because people were coming to me and saying, my gosh, that little bit there has changed my life. This has given me a different perspective. I can't wait to tell my partner about. And I've gone, oh gosh, okay, maybe there's something more to this. And so it has evolved almost organically since then. And now I get to travel the world. Well, I did before COVID. Starting to happen again. But I've spoken to 4,000 person audiences in Singapore. I've been to Vietnam and spoken to universities over there 3 times, been to America, New Zealand. A company made me go to Fiji with them, made me go to the Intercontinental Resort, made me stay there for 5 days. It was
really
hell
feel
on
sorry
earth.
For you.
But because of the way I've approached it and just that approach that I have taken that I'm able to pass on to other people, my life's sensational again. It was always going to be sensational, but it's sensational in many more ways. It's a very rich life.
So this is the new confident zone?
Yeah, for me, there's a lot of durability in what I'm doing now. There is a lot of transitioning back to resilience as well. And certainly when COVID hit and I had to completely change my business and go to online virtual, I went right back to fragile. But sometimes it's our ability to be vulnerable enough, as Brené Brown will tell you, be vulnerable enough to go, I've got a lot of learning to do here. You learn a lot faster. And you feel a lot more comfortable within yourself. You don't suffer the mental strain and stress that might be associated with trying to go, no, I'm 100% reliable. I'm so good, I'll be able to do this transition without even thinking about it. I've got this. No, we've all got new things to learn, and I had a lot to learn. So I've certainly been back and forwards along that continuum many times. And certainly when we started this podcast today, I've done a number of podcasts, and I felt more comfortable doing this. Certainly the first ones for me, it was, oh gosh, how do we do this? What if I say the wrong thing? But I know that you guys are all looking to make us all look good.
Yeah.
So if I make a really big gaffe, you will look after me. I'm hoping.
We've got 20 years of editing experience behind us, Derek. Don't you worry.
Or we'll blackmail you for the trip to Fiji.
Yeah, that's right.
I promise to take you on the next one. I promise.
This might be a question or a conversation indeed for like another time, but you were talking about the testosterone-filled environment with you know, when you're actually returning to work. Do you think that there is some work to be done in general around toxic masculinity, which has become another buzzword recently around all of the things that are happening around the moment with treatment of women and that sort of thing?
Let me think about that just for a moment. Absolutely. Mm. That's all it took me to think about that. No, absolutely. I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 59, grew up in the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s. The way we are now realizing what we used to do back then and what was acceptable back then, which was absolutely wrong, we've got a lot of learning to do. Unfortunately, some people don't want to change what they have done in the past. And it is hard. I understand that going through any change is difficult. But I think what we've got to do is look at the reality of our actions in the past. And this is not just about toxic masculinity. This is about the way we have treated races and nations and all the rest of it. We've got a lot of learning to do from our past experiences. But if we all want to grow towards a better future for ourselves, for our children, for the planet, essentially, then we've got to start learning from the past and changing for the future. But the toxic masculinity affects a lot of those areas that we're talking about.
Do you think it stems from a reluctance to show vulnerability, or do you think it's a lot broader than that?
You know, I look back at the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, men were expected by their male peers to be of a certain behaviour. And if you did show vulnerability to anything else, it was the case back in the 80s that, you know, that your mates would beat up on you, literally physically beat up on you. You were basically beaten into being that type of person if you wanted to fit into society. So the vulnerability has almost been beaten out of us. But when we're vulnerable enough to go, do you know something? I think there's a different way of doing this. That is actually a stronger position than just sticking to your guns and saying, no, I'm doing it right. Mm. And it's recognizing where the true strength comes from, which is one of the greatest things we can move forward. There's lots of, I mean, Prime Minister of Australia, Bob Hawke, when he cried on media, how much trouble did he get in with his peers, with all the testosterone-filled men? Mm. But now we realise that crying is one of the best things we can possibly do. If we are feeling something so emotional, we allow our feelings to flow naturally. It reduces stress. It allows us to share, allows people to be understanding of us. That vulnerability is invaluable.
You talk about strategies to help deal with that. Specifically, what's in your toolkit?
Specifically in my toolkit, my first go-to is always sleep. As soon as I start getting stressed, start getting overwhelmed, I look at my sleep patterns and go, have I been getting enough sleep? And to be quite honest, I'm not the greatest sleeper, not because I don't sleep well, just because I don't allow myself to go to sleep. So I look at my sleep first, and that's one of the most important things, because that's when our body just naturally replenishes, relaxes, and we wake up refreshed. I also look at my nutrition. What have I been eating lately? And don't get me wrong, I'm not a health freak. If I sit down with a packet of Tim Tams, I can easily stop at one packet. and that's, you know, honest. My friends all buy me packs of Tim Tams for my birthdays because they know I love them. But I do look at my nutrition. Have I been eating well? As much as I love my chocolates and my sweets, I also, you know, I will do quite often do dinner of steamed vegetables and with a little bit of herbs and spices on them because I know that's what I enjoy, but my body needs it. So I look at my nutrition. I look at my hydration as well. This is one that's highly underrated by people. If our body is not well hydrated, it doesn't operate optimally. And so that for me is another one. And then it's about what are the things that I enjoy doing that I relax and start getting the feed of good body brain chemicals into my body. One of them is spending time with my partner, spending time with my children. And as Louise and I was discussing this morning, I like bike riding. Mm. I went out for a 26-kilometre bike ride this morning, and I described it as just a little bike ride. 2 weeks ago,
just a tiny one.
2 weeks ago, I was on a charity ride, and charity is a big part of my life. I like contributing, but I went on a charity ride where we rode 1,000 kilometres in 7 days. So the 26 kilometres was just a little bike ride for me. But that's the sort of thing I like doing. But it's a strategy that I know. When I start getting stressed, get on the bike, Derek, and I don't have to push hard. I just need to get out and ride, because when I'm riding, my mind goes to a different place. And I love riding through the hills and looking at the trees, smelling the scents of that, going past gum tree. There's one place that I go through where I've got gum trees on one side, pine trees on the other, and the senses are just assaulted by these two beautiful aromas. And I know that that's what I enjoy doing. And when I do come back from my bike ride, I feel refreshed. But it's that those conscious strategies that we put into place, knowing the result that we want from them, that can really just break that tension, that stress, ability to be able to manage stress, connection with other people as well. We are social animals, and some people say I'm more social than the average animal. I like to be connected to people, and I like to talk and spend time. I've started learning how to dance, ballroom dance, Latin dancing, and I enjoy going out and socialising with those people. It's just a beautiful community to be in, and I know that replenishes me as well.
I'm always of the opinion that the way that other people treat you reflects more on how they feel about themselves than anything else. I'm wondering how that treatment for you has changed throughout your journey, because people would have been, I suppose, uncomfortable or not know what to say, not know how to handle it. What have you noticed?
Not know how to handle me talking about the shooting, yeah, or the fact that I was injured
or
so much.
Or the fact that you were injured, all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I have had many, many conversations where people say, Derek, can you tell us about that thing that happened to you? Can you tell us about that that accident? Do you know that? And I go, oh, you mean the shooting? Yes. Oh, you mean when I, excuse my language here, I sometimes say, you know, oh, you mean when I got the shit shot out of me? and because I am that relaxed about it. And when people start getting their head around that, they go, oh, so it's okay to talk about it. And that has changed over a period of time. But to put it into a different realm, during my time as a police officer, I was working with a very young girl whose sister died. Now, she was about 24 at the time. The sister was 27. I was in my 40s already. When her sister died, everybody was sort of walking around her not knowing, you know, what to say, where everybody's on eggshells. Mm. And she would just talk about her sister as if her sister was still alive, and say, oh, Casey would have put in her football tips as XYZ. And everybody's going, oh, my gosh, is she living in denial? She wasn't living in denial, and I had conversations with her about this. It was just like, well, I know it's happened. It's very upsetting for me, but she's still part of my life. She's not physically part of my life, but she's part of everything I think about when we have, you know, parties. You know, it's not that we will deny that she's not there, but we'll also talk about it. And it's becoming that comfortable with talking about our feelings. It still upsets her. She gets emotional. She gets teary about it from time to time, but she's still comfortable talking about it. I'm comfortable talking about the shooting because it's something that actually happened. Now, if it was maybe something, one of your children have died, the emotion are associated with that may be overwhelming. You may not want to talk about it. Everybody has their own different ways of being able to deal with these things. And I think it's finding out how other people want to deal with it themselves and managing it that way. But being open to going, if you're comfortable talking about it, then I'm comfortable talking about it as well. And having said that, I've been in conversations with people who don't know my history. And we've been talking about injuries. We've been talking about trauma, we've been talking about mental health, and I won't even mention the shooting because it's not an important part of that conversation. That's just something that happened to me that gave me some insights, gave me some experiences. When I almost have an accident in my car or when I have banged my car, that gives me insights as well. When I fall off my bike and, you know, break a bone, that gives me insights as well. The shooting is just one aspect of my life. It's not my whole life. It's not the dominant part of my life. It is something that people go, oh, wow, how did you deal with that? But then I bring in how I dealt with all these other things in my life as well that allowed me to deal with that shooting in the way that I did. And again, that comes back to the paper cut. You know, yeah. How we manage that paper cut will influence how we manage the bigger things in our lives as well.
You have an incredible story, Derek, and an incredible mindset. I'm in awe of everything you've been able to achieve and to have come to realizations with and help people with. Thank you so much for sharing all that with us today.
Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've gone into things in a different way today than what I've done in the past, and that's always good for me. So you've certainly dug into my mind in a different way as well.
We pushed you out of that confidence zone.
Hoping to make you fragile.
Well, to be quite honest, I hope you did for a little while there and then built me back up. Listen, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Next time on Reframe of Mind, we'll take a look at how we can apply what Derek has imparted to our own circumstances and chat to motivational speaker Chris Helder about finding that useful belief.
My idea of reframe is this idea of useful belief. And what's the difference between that and, as you say, toxic positivity? The studies out there really show that positive thinking, you know, is a band-aid and it doesn't work. And it's actually, the studies show you actually feel worse about yourself than when you started. So you know, and you're like, gosh, I can't even do positive well, and I tried to do positive. And really, positive thinking and negative thinking are emotive thinking.
You've been hearing our story, and now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with @ReframeOfMind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitter.
Or connect with @WelcomeChangeMedia on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. For more information on any of the subjects, guests, or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Just head to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.